from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. A report on the Guardian newspaper's website that placed the blame for a bombing attack on a food pantry in the east of Ukraine on local self-defense forces was apparently altered to shift the blame away from the actual perpetrators of the attack, Kiev's military. The report at the Guardian's website includes a one-paragraph caption beneath a video of the attack and its aftermath, with select parts of the audio featured under an English-language voiceover. This is the sound from the Guardian piece.
This dramatic video shows the moment a rocket hit a soup kitchen in eastern Ukraine, causing panic and chaos. Soup kitchen workers in the city of Pervomaisk can be seen running for cover as loud explosions rang out. Many of the women were in shock as they rushed across a courtyard to shelter in a basement. The building had been hit by rocket fire from pro-Russian rebels, leaving shattered windows and debris everywhere.
In actuality, the entire video montage, with the exception of a random and unrelated shot of a tank added towards the end, is a heavily edited version of the original video and audio of the bombing, which was captured by American journalist Patrick Lancaster, who's been in East Ukraine since the fighting began last year. Lancaster's video was posted at YouTube under his title, quote, Rocket Attack, Community Soup Kitchen in LNR-controlled Pervomaisk, hit by Ukraine Grad rockets, closed quote. The Guardian's report appears identical to one produced by the UK media outlet ITN News at its ODN website. Omitted from the Guardian ITN report are an interview and comments made under attack by those involved, placing the blame for the attack on Kiev's forces. But although the Guardian and or ITN appear to misuse Lancaster's footage to falsely blame the attacks on the rebels, his work is beginning to get out in other Western outlets. Lancaster reports at the website thetruthspeaker.co that his report was carried accurately by Sky News and The Independent in the UK and the New York Daily News here in the US. Elsewhere in East Ukraine, RT's Roman Kosarev met a woman who escaped from the war zone amid the latest escalation of bloodshed.
The town of Uglegorsk, on the front line between the Ukrainian army and anti-government forces. The streets are empty as people have fled the horrors of war.
There were a lot of dead bodies. A man and his wife were killed. The woman died on the spot, and the man was still alive when we put him in the basement and bandaged his leg. We called an ambulance, but it never arrived. I went away to get my things under the shelling. When I returned, he was already dead.
During the evacuation, Yelena was separated from her family. Her husband was sent to a nearby town while she went to Donetsk. She didn't have enough time to get her mom from the bomb shelter.
There was shelling somewhere over there, but here it was quiet and peaceful. I was trying to find my husband. I took my mother and two old ladies to a bomb shelter. And then I was put on a bus, and I couldn't go back.
Yelena used to have a small farm. Now she is one of more than 100 refugees accommodated in this medical college. Numerous other locations in and around Donetsk have become temporary homes for people displaced by war.
I was praying to God, and I thank my guardian angel that I'm still alive. Right now, I just want to forget everything, all this nightmare, this horror.
Many of those who fled the Debaltseve area are so terrified they refuse to speak on camera. Their hometowns completely destroyed, their lives shattered as the war rages on. And any hope of a new life seems a distant dream at best. Roman Kosarev, RT, Donetsk.
As the fighting continued Wednesday, another round of peace talks began in Minsk among the so-called Normandy Four, France's President François Hollande, German Chancellor Angela Merkel, Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko, and Russia's President Vladimir Putin. And as of late Wednesday, Some optimism was evident in at least some quarters. Stefan Dujarric, a spokesperson for UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, said that Secretary Ban expects the negotiations to result in a cessation of hostilities in the eastern part of Ukraine. But that optimism was not shared by all, as General Ben Hodges, the U.S. Army European commander, said hours before the start of the talks that the U.S. military will train Kiev troops fighting against the militias in southeast Ukraine. Scheduled to begin next month, he said, the training will involve a battalion of American troops training three battalions of Ukrainians. U.S. troops are apparently headed back to Iraq and perhaps to Syria. President Barack Obama sent Congress a proposed war powers resolution to authorize the use of military force. Press TV's Kovi Tavwe has more.
The proposal would allow the use of special forces and advisors for defensive purposes. Special forces can also take action against the leadership of the ISIL. Ground forces can also be used in rescue operations involving a U.S. or coalition personnel. Obama said that ISIL poses a threat to the U.S. homeland if left unchecked. Let's see what James Petras thinks. He's a professor at Binghamton University who joins us from New York. James Petras, this threat by the ISIL was known to the U.S. They came out 6 months ago with this U.S.-led coalition, but what Obama is asking for sounds like there's no limits to where, geographically speaking, forces can go, U.S. forces. Wouldn't that be somewhat not in accordance with some of the regional countries, for example, Iran?
I think it's a very ominous move because it coincides with Washington's threat to arm the junta in Kiev. I think the latest policies of Obama's military strategy is directed toward expanding U.S. influence and power and overthrowing the Syrian government. I think ISIL is a pretext to directly involve the U.S. in Syria and to actively pursue a two-front policy of one attacking ISIL, but strategically aiming at overthrowing Bashar Assad and imposing a U.S. Puppet regime. I think it's extremely dangerous. It's extremely interventionist, and it coincides with Israeli policy, which essentially is opposed to the alliance between Syria, Iran, and Hezbollah, Lebanon. So I think this has very ominous consequences for the region. I think it will further destabilize the political configurations. But more important, I think it'll tip the balance in Lebanon toward the extreme right-wing Christians who are engaged in an alliance with Israel. I think that the Obama administration is essentially looking to impose its influence in Syria.
So if we were to take a look at what Obama said that he wasn't going to do, because that's what the American people didn't want, and that was wage a war against Syria, you figured this may have been part of a game plan?
Well, I think the pretext is ISIL, but the real target is the independent government of Syria. I think the Israelis are very much involved. Netanyahu's visit to the United States is part and parcel of this united strategy, despite whatever differences the U.S. may have tactically with Israel regarding the peace negotiations with Iran. I think the Israelis and the U.S. Have a common goal of first overthrowing the Syrian government and then encircling Lebanon and then moving forward toward attacking Iran. So I think a lot is at stake in the U.S. Direct military intervention. This is not defensive. This is not a operation strictly limited to ISIL. This is an offensive operation. It's U.S. boots on the ground in Syria, and there's no way of distinguishing between a defensive and an offensive war. This is a myth. This is a fiction. Once the U.S. troops are there, they're going to be shooting in two directions, one toward ISIL and one toward the Syrian government. Let's not forget the U.S. has been supplying the so-called Syrian opposition with arms, logistical support, training since the beginning of this so-called civil war.
Libya is entering its fifth year of fighting. 4 years after a massive nine-month U.S.-led bombing campaign began, which enabled the takeover of the country by a variety of foreign and emigre fighters, armed and funded by Saudi Arabia and Qatar, Libya remains in what the U.N. High Commissioner for Human Rights called the worst political crisis and escalation of violence in the country since the government was overthrown in 2011. The country is now split between at least two groups claiming to be the legitimate government, with powerfully armed groups, according to the High Commissioner, quote, committing violations of international human rights and humanitarian law with impunity, closed quote. A report to be presented to the UN Human Rights Council in March documents numerous incidents of targeted violence against civilians, including children. Unlawful killings in the country have reportedly become commonplace. Stephanie Kutrix reports from the United Nations.
Harassment, torture, abductions, assassinations, and executions. The newest OHCHR report on the human rights situation in Libya in 2014 highlights what the agency calls the extreme vulnerability of people in the country. While there have been attempts at ceasefires and political dialogue, OHCHR says civilians continue to be victims of indiscriminate artillery and air attacks. Footage appearing to show a number of beheadings in Benghazi and Derna also emerged last November. Rupert Colville, spokesperson for OHCHR, has more on the report.
It paints a bleak picture of increasing turmoil and lawlessness fanned by a multitude of heavily armed groups amid a broadening political crisis. Rampant violence and fighting, including in the country's two biggest cities, Tripoli and Benghazi, as well as many other cities and towns across the country, is badly affecting civilians in general and a number of specific groups in particular.
Those groups include many women, especially female human rights defenders, politicians, and other women in public positions. Stephanie Kutrix, United Nations.
UN brokered talks, the time and location of which were not released for security reasons, were supposed to begin this week in an attempt to end the political and security crisis in Libya. The UN's top envoy for the country, Bernardino Leon, spoke with journalist Reem Abaza about the prospects for success of political dialogue given the situation on the ground.
Most of the Libyans, I believe, are pushing us and are pushing their political representatives and the militias to negotiate. A minority, but a noisy minority, and people who hold weapons and have power in some cases are against. Our challenge is to make sure that this majority will have enough support from the international community to prevail on the minority.
So we can say that all the main groups on the ground, the political, the militias, all the groups are participating in the political dialogue?
We can say that today there is all mainstream groups, the most influential groups in both the political and the military realms in both camps fighting in Libya are now supporting this political process UN-led.
How would you assess the success of the dialogue while it's going on, while the process is going on?
Well, we have agreed on an agenda. This agenda should include in the first stage the unity government and the stabilization program, including ceasefire, weapons control, militias leaving cities and strategic facilities, and monitoring. If we can achieve these two very urgent goals, we will be solving maybe 75%, 80% of the current problems in Libya. If we can get in the coming weeks this ceasefire and especially the unity government, I think we will have achieved a lot.
You are in constant contacts with all the groups in Libya. What is the UN exactly doing other than that to try to push the political dialogue forward?
Well, the UN is not only working on the political field. This is the main activity and obviously is the one that attracts more the media. But we are also working on the humanitarian field. We are promoting some humanitarian action in Nafusa region, in Warshafana and Benghazi. We have also other agencies working on health and refugees. Obviously, there are many challenges that stem from the civil war, a lot of people suffering, and I think practically all UN agencies are doing their best to provide support.
Argentina's President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner faces a Western Fed intrigue playing out at home with an apparent demonization campaign in full swing in Western media and the House of Representatives in Washington. Manuel Gaffoni reports from Buenos Aires.
The Argentine government had a harsh reaction following a debate held at the U.S. House of Representatives about sending a delegation to garner information related to the investigation of the death of prosecutor Alberto Nisman. Dr. Nisman had filed a criminal complaint against the Argentine president for allegedly obstructing the inquest into the 1994 bombing of the AMIA Jewish Center in Buenos Aires. The prosecutor was found dead of a gunshot wound in his home the day before he was set to testify at the parliament about the complaint. The Argentine ambassador to the U.S., Mrs. Cecilia Naon, has explained the legal measures being taken in Argentina to properly probe the case. She also warned the U.S. lawmakers that any attempt to meddle in Argentina's domestic affairs will be regarded as a violation of sovereignty.
We are forced to strengthen our position into the U.S. Congress, as there is a lot of misleading information being spread out there.
Right after the death of Nisman, under unclear circumstances, several U.S. congressmen were pushing for sanctions on some Argentinian top officials, which was deemed by Buenos Aires as an unjustified interference. It slammed the move as an imperial behavior. Argentinian lawmakers followed suit.
In my opinion, it's nonsense. If for any reason Argentina had asked for their cooperation, or if they have something to say about the case, they should do it only through diplomatic channels.
According to information released by WikiLeaks, the U.S. has been interfering in the AMIA probe from the beginning. The CIA and the Mossad have leveled ungrounded accusations against Iran in the AMIA case. Meanwhile, the U.S. ambassador to Argentina played an active role in setting the steps Prosecutor Nisman had to take in the investigations.
Their continuing attitude confirms that the investigations that transformed Iran into the perpetrator of the bombings were part of a cover-up in which the United States actively participated. As all the evidences against Iran are absolutely fragile or non-existent, under these circumstances, the best the U.S. could do is to refrain from intervening.
Top government officials denounced that behind these U.S. Congress moves, there's a plot to destabilize the government prior to the 2015 presidential elections. Manuel Gaffoni, Press TV, Buenos Aires.
For more on this, we now go to our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo. Tony, we've seen the Western media completely misrepresent the situation there in Nicaragua, for example, over the canal, and the situation in Venezuela, of course, where they accuse the government of all kinds of horrible crimes and never report when it's proven that, in fact, either the opposition of the U.S. performed the crimes if they occurred. Now, Argentina. Tell us about this.
This same kind of coverage has applied to what in many ways is a tragic case of this public prosecutor, Alberto Nisman, in Argentina, who was appointed by Néstor Kirchner, the much-lamented former president of Argentina, who died some years ago, and was his widow, Cristina Fernández de Kirchner, was elected president subsequent to him. And has proved an extremely capable leader, perhaps the most capable political leader in Argentina. I don't think there's any question about that. But what happened with Alberto Nisman was that he was appointed by Néstor Kirchner in 2005, I think it was, to continue the investigation into what was a really horrific terrorist attack in Argentina. I think it was in 1994. I might be wrong about that.
No, you're 1995. Right. Yeah, 11 years earlier. Yep.
Yeah, it was the Argentinian-Israeli mutual associations building, the AMIA building in downtown Buenos Aires, and it was blown up, killing 85 people and wounding hundreds. And it was a really horrific terrorist attack. The investigation into that is still ongoing. There's been no definitive result in any sense. And what the investigation has become, it reminds me very much of the Lockerbie affair. And you remember the Lockerbie bombing back whenever it was, when an airliner. I've forgotten the airline now. But an airliner en route, I think it was to New York, was blown out of the sky over the Scottish town of Lockerbie. And there was much confusion subsequently as to who may have been responsible for it. Some people were accusing the Iranian government. Some people were accusing a fraction of the Palestinian liberation movements. Sometime after the terrorist attack, Libya was accused. And, of course, Libya never accepted responsibility for that bombing. And the guy who was actually convicted of it, on a long drawn out political process, actually now the very families of the people who were murdered in that terrorist attack are now trying to clear this guy's name because they regard the whole process as having been completely corrupted for political purposes. And the same thing has happened with the Amir bombing in 1994. And that has been manipulated largely by Argentinian factions that support the United States and are susceptible to manipulation by the Israeli secret service Mossad. And that's been very clear over the last, what, almost 20 years now.
You know what's interesting here in the narrative in the U.S. media, anyway, that I've read? This is what's missing. Within Argentina, there's a strong component of right-wing ultra-nationalists who, you know, were the main constituency for the dictatorships that they had before the last couple of presidents. They're still there, and they're anti-Semites, and hardcore. They're Nazis, in essence, in Argentina.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
On the ground. And no one even mentions that fact in a discussion of, you know, well, who might have been responsible for the bombing, and instead they're focusing on trying to pin this somehow on Cristina Fernandez.
Yeah, and so, and many people listening might not remember the history of Argentina, but during the military dictatorship that lasted from something like 1976 to 1983, over 35,000 people were disappeared, effectively murdered. And in that process, and one could talk for a long time about this, but in relation to the Amir bombing, and as you've pointed out, the junta that ran Argentina, the military dictators that ran Argentina during that time were effectively Nazi sympathizers. And so a lot of the people, of those 35,000 people that got disappeared, were Jewish. And they were tortured, in some cases, deliberately, provocatively, underneath portraits of Adolf Hitler. And that's very well documented. And the obvious suspects for that bombing in the early 1990s of the Amir building are, in fact, the local Nazi pointed out viciously anti-Jewish, anti-Semitic. But, of course, that gets left out of the narrative because there's this weird alliance, and you can see it in Colombia as well, and the alliance between the extreme right, people who are naturally racist, sympathizing with Israel and getting support from Israel, and you get the same phenomenon there in the Southern Cone, in countries like Chile and in Argentina. What happened in Nisman's case was that he was appointed Kirchner because at that time Nestor Kirchner was frankly disgusted with the lack of progress on the investigation. And all that seems to have happened is that Alberto Nisman, according to reports by really quite eminent journalists, well thought of journalists, not even left wing, kind of center left journalists like Santiago O'Donnell, I think he writes the Página 12, the very well known Argentinian media outlet. And they've written books about the way Nisman was subverted by the US embassy. And how he became dependent on the U.S. embassy and on sources within the Argentinian intelligence intelligence services sympathetic to the United States agenda in the region. And so happened was, ironically, that Nixon's effort to clean up the investigation into the AMI affair was actually subverted by the United States Embassy through that period. And it's our Argentinian allied interests who wanted the investigation to be perverted and distorted. And what happened in the case of Nisman was that those interests, and this is to some extent, this is what the Argentinian government is saying, but it's also what a lot of progressive journalists in Argentina are saying. And Nisman was used by interests sympathetic to Israel and to the United States, the Israeli government, and to the U.S. government. And it's likely that interests involved with those governments were responsible for his murder. But what's happened in the international corporate media is that all that background is left out.
Right.
And what they highlight are the accusations made by this tiny minority in Argentina accusing the Argentinian government, and specifically President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, of in some way being responsible for the murder.
And on top of that, what they're doing, they're suggesting basically that they're stating almost as fact in the New York Times that the bombing was conducted by spies working for the Islamic Republic of Iran, and that Kirchner made some kind of dirty deal to cover it up. That's what they're suggesting.
Yeah, and if one looks at the evidence, one of the accusations that Nisman made, the indictment? Is that the word, term for the prosecution's case that's presented to the
presentation
court?
Of criminal charges and indictment, yeah.
Yeah, so that indictment, local Argentinian lawyers, very eminent lawyers, not necessarily at all supportive or connected directly in any way to the Argentinian government, have stated that Nisman's indictment, Nisman's case, as presented to the court, is so poorly written that they don't believe that it was written by him. And so that's one thing in relation to the case. And all his main points or charges are undermined by external evidence. For example, he alleges that the Cristina Kirchner government requested Interpol to suspend red alerts against individuals suspected of involvement in the case. But even Ronald Noble, the United States Interpol official who was at that time, at the time of the alleged move by the Kirchner government to suspend those red alerts, even Ronald Noble, the head of Interpol, wrote to say that was completely untrue. And another accusation is that Argentinian government under Kirchner received some kind of economic benefit from an under-the-table deal with Iran. Mm. But the figures and the statistics show that was not the case. And so you can go through the accusations made by Nisman, and each one of them is deeply flawed.
And we don't even know if they're actually made by Nisman.
Quite.
Right. I mean, because actually, I misspoke before. Well, an indictment is the preparation and presentation of criminal charges. And we didn't have that, actually. It wasn't actually fulfilled, because those charges were never presented. As a matter of fact, it's claimed they were found in his garbage can.
There was a weird report of a secret passageway that may have facilitated access for the murder to the exclusive apartment block in which Albert Nisman was living at the time. And the weapon, he's alleged to have committed suicide with a pistol that belonged to somebody else. And so there are all kinds of questions around what happened in Nisman's murder, and actually what was the network on which he was depending in order to present his accusations against the Argentinian government.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.